are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, brought to you by the Star Legacy Foundation. Visit us online at starlegacyfoundation.org. This month's guest is Dr. Barbara Toppin, a board-certified OBGYN with many years of experience in women's healthcare. She currently works at an OB clinic in Woodbury, Minnesota. Dr. Toppin has won multiple awards for being a top OB and is the author of a book called One in Four, Shifting the Balance on Pregnancy Loss. In this book, Dr. Toppin reveals the blind eye turned on clotting disorders, one of the most prevalent causes of pregnancy loss. Affecting nearly 42% of the population, clotting disorders often go undetected in women, yet are a primary cause of miscarriages. But as Dr. Toppin illustrates in her book, they can be treated easily and systematically.
Well, Dr. Toppin, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I guess my first question, I want to start with talking about your book and what inspired you to write this book and how do you hope people respond to the book?
Well, during my residency program, I was profoundly affected by a patient I met. I think she was in my third year of residency program, and I was doing a preoperative physical on her, and she was about to have a tubal sterilization. I inquired about her pregnancy history, and I saw that she had had six miscarriages. And what inspired me was the fact that this patient was going to have a permanent tubal sterilization without any children, and clearly she wanted to have them. And when I questioned her about having another pregnancy, she said she did not have the heart to do it. And that really bothered me a lot because I knew at the time that there was something. I was always willing to go forth and try to help her, but she said she couldn't do any more loss, so she could not take it, and she just wanted to be done with it.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. You had this experience, and over your career, you've clearly kept that in the back of your head, and you've wanted to do something about it. Let's talk about how that one experience has impacted your career and the book, and it's kind of the way you define yourself as a doctor, it seems like, in many ways. Is that correct?
It is correct, and in fact, it is my passion. I named the book One in Four simply because about 25% of pregnancies will end in loss. And that seems to be really a large number. It makes me really unhappy to know that there are women out there suffering, or families, in fact, out there suffering pregnancy losses without any sort of answer. And so as my career proceeded, of course, with a 25% loss rate, one is always going to see a loss. And we have lots of patients who've come in, they've had miscarriages, or they have miscarriages with us, and it's a very sad event. And patients always want to know why. They want to know if there was anything they had done wrong or something they had taken, and they're more than willing to try anything. And when patients have gotten up to the numbers of two and three losses, they're desperate. And I really hate to see someone desperate, and my natural inclination would be to try to help them.
One in Four is a powerful title for a book, and I'm curious to know what the reaction has been to that title, specifically among maybe first-time parents or people of the general public who might not know about that statistic. What do people think about when you tell them what one in four really means?
Well, in fact, it's usually the first-time parents who have lost a pregnancy who find this out at that time. It's pregnancy loss in general, whether it's a stillbirth that is later in the pregnancy or an early pregnancy loss, is often kind of hidden in the background. A lot of families don't talk about it because, of course, it's a sad event. And they just don't want to think about it anymore. Especially if they go on to have normal pregnancies without any problems, they just put it in the back of their minds, and the doctors do too. We're taught not to really react to the early losses in particular, and it makes us less empathetic, in fact, because we're just not there with the patient. We're not on the foreground with the patient, and we're not allowing ourselves to feel what they feel and put ourselves in their place, which we really need to do.
Let's get a little more scientific here and talk about clotting disorders. Talk about this, and help me pronounce this word that is this the central point of your book, the other way to describe clotting disorder?
Thrombophilia.
Thank you. I will not say that again. What is it, and what do expecting parents need to know about it?
Well, thrombophilia is a tendency toward having blood clots. They are usually genetic predisposition, so they're genes. It's not a disease. A lot of people harbor this. In fact, I believe many more people than we know have these genes. When one has a genetic predisposition toward having a blood clot, and they become pregnant, which in fact is thought to be a hypercoagulable state in and of itself, they get kind of a double whammy. So those patients who come in with either early or later pregnancy loss, we may in fact see that they form little tiny blood clots that basically clot off parts of the placenta. Baby needs oxygen and nutrition to grow. It's a pretty simple equation. You need oxygen, nutrition, to be able to grow and survive and thrive in utero. If there's something clogging the piping there, then in fact they're going to get less of what they need. So it is not uncommon with early pregnancy loss or stillbirth to see that the babies are smaller than we expect on ultrasound. So a patient may come in and she is supposed to be 10 weeks, but we see her growth lagging behind at about 6, 7, maybe 8 weeks. And that doesn't bode well for the pregnancy. If they're able to make it out of the first trimester, we can see the same things in the second and third trimester, which can in fact result in intrauterine growth restriction.
Even though the name of this podcast is called Stillbirth Matters, the intended audience for this podcast is really any family who has experienced any sort of pregnancy loss at any stage of pregnancy. You have done a lot of work with women who experience first trimester pregnancy losses. This is a very broad question, but I'd love to hear your answer to what is your approach for working with these women who have experienced this first trimester pregnancy loss?
Well, it's a similar approach to the losses at any age. First of all, it is to acknowledge the loss and the pregnancy. We've, as physicians, have given early pregnancy loss a lot of crazy names like missed abortion or blighted ovum. If your pregnancy test is positive, then you were pregnant, and we acknowledge that. Acknowledge the loss and really allow patients to have their questions answered about their feelings at first, because a lot of patients, as I said before, will come in and feel, oh, it's because I was working, or it's because I worked out, or it's because I did this, and we reassure them that it's nothing that they've done. The next thing would be a careful history. What I find is that with many pregnancy losses, the provider does not actually look at the patient's history, their own personal and family history. So when a patient comes to me and she has had a pregnancy loss, or recurrent pregnancy loss is what I deal with more of, it is not infrequent that I will ask them, well, are your parents alive? If they're alive, do they have medical problems? If they're deceased, what medical problems have they died of? If I have a patient who comes in and says, well, yeah, my father passed away at age 45 of a heart attack, I kind of know there's something lurking in the genes. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. There's something there. He didn't. And many patients say, well, they said it was because he was obese, or he was diabetic, or he was hypertensive. Those are cofactors. They don't necessarily cause the problem. They are just the additional things that push the person over the edge. So it is a trigger for me with a family history or a personal history of blood clots or heart attacks, strokes, even migraines, migraines with aura, to do testing, which brings us to the next thing. We do a physical examination. Often that does not show us anything. We do cultures, in particular cultures for STDs, but other cultures like ureaplasm and mycoplasm, which are some bacteria that can be present and cause early pregnancy loss too. The blood tests we do are thrombophilia labs, so there's a large list of thrombophilia labs. And right now I have a favored group of tests called the expanded carrier testing, which is new and exciting. With some of the new companies and expanded carrier testing, we can test for not only my thrombophilias that I so want to know about, but it gives us insight into some other genes that patients may carry and really can affect a fetus if their spouse or partner has those same genes. So there's a lot of new information that's coming out all the time. So expanded carrier tests, I really love to do. Thrombophilia testing, I love to do. Occasionally, if we think there's an abnormality in the uterine shape, we will do a hysterosalpingogram. We do cultures, that careful history, and the physical, of course. And that kind of takes care of the whole package of how we then will sit down with the patient and make a plan of action, because it is individualized.
You mentioned that a lot of what you do is not rocket science. But at the same time, I know that a doctor such as yourself represents hope to a lot of families, maybe a family that has experienced multiple miscarriages. They go to someone like Dr. Toppin to try to solve the problem. From your perspective, any of the testing or any of the ways that you approach these types of patients, is there anything that can be done on the front end from a standardized perspective so that people like you aren't so necessary to solving the problem?
Yes, in fact. When patients come to me, and I have the luxury of having a patient who comes in for pre-pregnancy planning, we talk about a lot of tests. We talk about the typical tests that are mentioned by the March of Dimes. So those are torch testing, so toxoplasmosis, if you have a cat and it's outdoor cat, cytomegalic virus, parvovirus, rubella, German measles, which is rubella, measles, and varicella. Those viral tests are very important because if you're not immunized, we recommend immunization. And in the case of those that don't have immunizations, we are able to at least tell the patient if she is in an immune status or non-immune status, which some of those viral problems can cause pregnancy loss. So it's important to have that beforehand. We make sure the patient is in the proper diet and exercise mode. Unfortunately, we have a problem with obesity in this country. It can be linked to miscarriage as well as stillbirth. So we encourage our patients to get to their desired weight goals and get into an exercise program that they can continue when they become pregnant. We also ask them to start on prenatal vitamins with folic acid because it covers a lot of bases. Once we get our expanded carrier testing back, if the patient chooses to do that, then we many times, unfortunately or fortunately, have to test the partner. And then there is the company we use actually has a genetics counselor that will chat with a patient and her spouse over the phone and give all the pertinent information, and then we counsel our patient. So once in a while, we have a patient who comes in and she has an unknown thrombophilia. If she has an unknown thrombophilia, our approach is to inform the patient of the thrombophilia and make a plan with the patient that is most comfortable for her, because I don't have a need to be right, but I don't like to be wrong. And so when I have a patient who comes in and I find there's a problem and I'm able to interact beforehand, well, I state in my book, you can't prove prevention, but she would think less of me if I found out information and didn't at least offer her treatment of some sort. And when the treatment is something as simple as aspirin, most often the patients are willing to take it and try it. Does it work all the time? No, nothing is 100%, but we keep an eye on those patients throughout their pregnancy, and it really does help. And we have a lot of appreciative moms to speak up for this. And if you've never, my goal is not to be right. My goal is for the patient never to experience or suffer from my lack of knowledge. So, you know, when they come in and they've had a miscarriage, I say, you have nothing to prove. It's for me to prove to you. And I say the same to patients who haven't had a miscarriage, who haven't been pregnant. We want to really get that information out so they don't have to suffer.
Listening to you talk right now, I'm just wondering, when you were a young student who decided you wanted to be an OB, what was your motive at that time for going into this field? Was it you wanted to be surrounded by happiness and joy of babies being delivered in this world? Or did you think you wanted to specialize in working with these families that you're working with today who have experienced loss?
Well, I actually wanted to be an astronaut.
Don't we all?
Nowadays. But in fact, I really had no idea until I went through the program of what the potential for pregnancy loss was. I knew that I wanted to deliver babies, and I knew that there could be bad outcomes. But being a layperson before I went to medical school, I was like everyone else. I thought miscarriage was something that you heard about kind of in some old novel. You heard about someone who lost a baby. I didn't realize that women would lose their babies as often as they do. And far more important, our country is not the best for prevention, whether it's perinatal mortality or maternal mortality or recurrent pregnancy loss. We are not in the forefront. I want to see us in the forefront of in the world. We should be leaders. We should not allow this to happen.
So I'll turn that question back around on you. Do you have an idea or ideas for how the United States can become a leader in this space? Is there a simple solution in your head, or is it multiple things?
Well, I have an idea for a long-term study, which would probably last beyond my life span, but I do know that with thrombophilias, there is a potential for and early recurrent pregnancy loss for these genetic predispositions to affect people later in their lives, to cause heart attack, stroke, pulmonary emboli. That is the number one cause. Cardiovascular deaths are the number one cause of deaths in this country. These genes that people harbor tend to turn on naturally with age, which is why years ago, when women were having babies at age 15, Mother Nature says, have your baby at 15. That's normal. Well, we didn't see it very often, but when women started to wait until their late 30s and late 20s, 30s, 40s to have babies, they actually started to have more miscarriages. That's when we see those problems. So I think a very simple solution would be to look at those women and give those women an opportunity to improve their lifestyle through either aspirin use or folic acid or whatever it is that we need to do to prevent them from having problems. And in fact, I am lucky enough to have had a few patients recently who have been my patients for the 17 years that I have been in Minnesota who have now come back in their 40s and 50s and said, well, you know, I had this, but I was on the aspirin and I didn't have a problem. So they recognize it. So education of the patient is key to prevention. I think if a patient knows, just like if you know you overeat that you're going to have an increased chance of a medical problem, if you know you have a predisposition, not a disease, that you're going to avoid certain things. So in the case of my OB patients, I tell them, if you test positive for thrombophilia, you're not a good candidate for hormonal replacement. You're not a good candidate for birth control pills. Just taking those two things away from patients may reduce their risk of heart attack, stroke, and pulmonary emboli. And what's more important now, well, not more important, but equally important, is that with our expanded carrier testing, we are finding men who are testing positive. So how great would it be to have a young dad and say, well, you know, you harbor these genes, it's putting you at a higher risk of having a heart attack and leaving your family at a young age and sending them off to their doctors. But unfortunately, there's a little bit of a disconnect between doctors. Everybody has their part and they kind of want to take care of that part and they don't really care about the other part. So we would like to see a coming together, you know, looking at the patient as a whole and saying this is a continuum. It's not just the miscarriage. It's not just a stillbirth. It is your life. And this is how we can help to affect it. We all will die someday, but we don't have to suffer along the way.
It is such an inspiring idea. Getting there is another challenge. But I really hope it happens. That's a fantastic idea. What are the biggest challenges you face when working with families who have had several losses?
Unfortunately, I would say other physicians. And I don't want to throw my colleagues under the bus, but I will, because I have made a really huge practice based on women who have suffered a lot and have had PTSD as a result of their pregnancy losses, and they just are at a point where they feel like they're going to tear their hair out. And I really don't like seeing that. It makes them extremely nervous. It makes me nervous. And it puts a lot of pressure on us to have to get it right that first time. Other doctors frequently do not want to do the testing. I just spoke with a patient who is not actually my patient. She's from a different state and asked me to review her records. And her statement today was that her doctor said he didn't really want to do any other testing on her for her losses. And that, in fact, she asked him to consult with me, and he said, I don't have time for that. The reason I have a lot of these patients is that they kind of seek me out. They hear of me through other physicians or family members, and then they go away happy. But their question is always, well, why wouldn't my doctor do this if this is relatively common knowledge? I don't have an answer for that. So I think better physician education, allowing ourselves to actually entertain that a pregnancy is a pregnancy, whether it was 6 weeks at a loss or 36 weeks, it doesn't make a difference. It's a loss for the patient. And that we do have time to sit there and brainstorm with the individual. Some of my best ideas have come from my patients, in fact. So they do a lot of research. They find out a lot of information. And I'm willing to try anything that's not going to harm them if it's a test. And within reason, I'm able to say to a patient, well, this test will be helpful because of this, or it may not be helpful because of that, or it may open up a can of worms that we don't want to get into because we may have to do something else yet again, and let the patient make her decision. I'm not perfect, but I think that other doctors in their own search for their personal perfection should learn to listen to their patients and look and learn more information and be thoughtful about the whole person that's sitting there in front of them.
Well, Dr. Toppin, on behalf of all of our listeners, I want to thank you for taking the time to share your really honest insights with us today.
Thank you again for having me, and I hope it helps.
That's all for this month's episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.